As the year comes to an end, now might be the time to start thinking about how you'll like to change in the coming year. That's why we're getting ready for the next round of our cohorts starting in the second week of January. We're going to continue running our flagship 8-week cohort to help you be more effective at business development. And if you're starting out in your career, we've got a powerful 6-week hands-on workshop for associates as well to help you build your network and get ready for the next leap forward in your career. Practical skills built on accountability, constant coaching, feedback, in a way that feels real. If you're interested, check out buildyourbook.org/academy. All right, on to this week's episode. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Build Your Book podcast. This is your host, Aaron Bear and Double Tank. Every week, we bring to you stories about the legal profession to help lawyers build a better book of business, a better practice, and a better life. Let's get started.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of the Build Your Book podcast. And as always, we've got another amazing guest. Today, this is a special one. We've got Eric Jansen here with us. He's an entrepreneur and an educator, and he's a professor at the business school that both Dowell and I went to, and we're so excited to have him here. So Eric, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me. Let's get into it.
All right. So Eric, Dowell and I both graduated from business school at Ivy in 2011. And at the time, there were no sales courses. I don't think anyone in our class wanted to go into sales. And the push seemed to be finance, consulting, accounting, marketing. That seemed like all you could do. And yet here we are, you're teaching one of the most popular, if not the most popular classes at Ivy. And I want to start sort of, you know, what are you teaching? What is that journey? But first of all, tell us a bit about yourself. How did you end up teaching today? And what was your journey in sales like?
Sure. I had ambitions of being an entrepreneur from a really early age and started experimenting with that as a student. And when I graduated, I tried to get as much, I wanted to jump into it and see what it was like at a small company. I had done things on my own, but wanted to see what it was like at a progressively larger entrepreneurial organization. So I joined a family business. Then I joined a Silicon Valley-based tech startup that was on the brink of raising a bunch of money before joining a tech-based company as a partner and ultimately the chief revenue officer. So I've always been the sales side of any entrepreneurial partnership. I think in early and growth stage companies, you're either building something that people want or you're selling it. And the value that I added was on the sales side. After doing that for over a decade, I realized that a lot of the things that I learned, I wish I would have learned when I was in school or a little bit earlier on versus mostly screwing things up and learning them the hard way. And so I packaged up a lot of the things that I learned, figured out the 80-20, and then came back to Ivy to start teaching those things full time. It's crazy, Aaron, that you mentioned wasn't a course that's offered that was offered at Ivy when you were there. That's not uncommon. I think sales is taught at less than 5% of higher education institutions in North America. And yet 80% of business grads end up in some sort of a sales role. 60% of all university or college grads end up in a sales role. And yet we're teaching it in less than 5% of schools. So that's broken. And I think on the brink of being changed.
Yeah. And it's amazing. You know, I think we talk a lot about in law about how legal education is broken, but there's so much in general in education. And the thing I love about Ivy is that the professors are actually practitioners too. In law school, most of the professors are people who had no interest in ever practicing. Maybe they practice for 6 months if you were lucky. And most of them have not done anything practical other than research in 20 years. And that never made any sense to me. I want somebody who's out there, you know, living and breathing this stuff and knows what's going on and is up to date on things. And sales obviously has changed. It's evolved over the last year and a half in the pandemic, but obviously there's a lot going on that if you've been an academic for the last 20 years, you wouldn't know unless you're living and breathing it. So why is your course popular? That's my first question. Like, I know you're a great professor, but why do people want to come to your course? Why do they want to learn sales?
I think that sales is valuable whether you're going to be a management consultant, a lawyer, frankly, an investment banker, an entrepreneur, or an accountant. Like, it really doesn't matter what you do as a full-time career. Sales as a foundational skill is valuable. It's interesting, right? When you get people who want to be consultants their first year, a few years out of school, they do really well. The promotion track is generally you become like a junior associate. You do a lot of analyst work if you stick around, because it's a grind of a job, but you stick around and you slowly get promoted until one day you become a partner. And guess what? Your full-time responsibility is actually growing revenue or sales. If you're an accountant or really any employee at even a large company, and you get any sort of sway in the organization or become a manager, you're going to have to start putting together budgets and building a team. And you're going to have to make the case for why someone should invest in your group versus another group, even internally. Like, all of these things rely on foundational sales skills. It's not just art. There's a little bit of a science to it. And I think that all of those things can be taught. And so that was the positioning of the course. It wasn't, you know, sales for people who want to be full-time salespeople. It wasn't get your career kickstarted in enterprise selling. This is a foundational skill that's going to be valuable no matter what career that you choose. And I think that's part of the appeal.
The real question here is that, how do you teach this in an engaging way? Because sales is often seen as something you do in the trenches, not something that's taken up in a more academic environment. How are you kind of flipping that model around and actually giving people the practical skills they need to sell?
I think some of it is reframing the way that people think about sales. So a lot of people say, you know, students, you can't teach through lecture. Students hate lectures. Partially true, but I think they hate boring lectures. I think if the lectures are short and engaging and impactful and are based on storytelling and real life examples, then I can actually probably hold their attention for 10 or 15 or 20 minutes at a time. So reframing, I think, some things that some opinions that people have about sales or the way that they think sales is conducted that actually aren't true is part of how I teach it. So an example might be, you know, you think of a salesperson, is it overly used stereotypes? There's a bunch of them. But salespeople are, you know, on their hands and knees begging for business. So it's about being your cold calling people, and it's about numbers and getting rejected and moving on from rejection and making 100 dials and getting one person to respond positively. Partially, I mean, that might be true. There's an element of work ethic involved for sure, and there's an element of rejection. But what if we reframed it and said it's not about spraying and praying? It's not about, you know, making 100 calls to some list that you downloaded online and loading up a bunch of okay written emails into some automated thing. What if we said, let's spend a few minutes and think about who our ideal customer is. And you know what? The questions that you ask should be geared around trying to figure out if they are your ideal customer. And if they're not, you should tell them that they're not a good fit to work with you. So I think rejecting some myths that people have around their approach to sales is one element of how I teach it. And that's some lecture, some storytelling. The second is, you're right, you got to get out there and do it. So we can talk about some of these concepts till I'm blue in the face, and I can do it in an entertaining way and hold an audience. But unless you get people to go out there and actually try it, it's going to fall flat. So there's two examples come to mind. One is, I call it the trade up challenge. So I give my students a $5 Amazon gift card, and they've got 2 weeks to trade it up to something of ideally much higher value. And what they end up doing is, they starting with the Amazon gift card, you'll get groups that say, we're going to launch a social media campaign, and it's a student project, and, you know, tweet and Instagram post and promote that we're doing this thing, and who wants to make a trade. You'll get other students who have a very focused strategy, and they'll say, I'm going to go after Aaron and see, you know, here's a unique, different story that I'm going to pitch to specifically Aaron versus broadcasting it to a large group. So they actually apply some of the tactics of being, you know, focused strategy. What's the value proposition that you're going to pitch Aaron versus DeWall? And ultimately, they apply a lot of the learnings in class. And then we had a team last year that traded a $5 Amazon gift card into a 2014 Hyundai Santa Fe last year. So a used car, an actual working used car. The third thing is, they have to apply it in context. So we do progressively more high stakes role plays. So we'll start with, you know, some live examples of role plays in class. Then I'll put them in breakout rooms where they practice with one another, culminating in a final, call it a project, where I actually hire a team of actors and they get to really have a real live sales meeting with these actors and then debrief on it and coach each other on it afterwards. But that's, you know, we build to that towards the end of the semester.
That sounds fascinating. This idea of busting myths. And I think that's something that we come across all the time. The first one that you talked about is this idea that, well, you know, it's about shooting in the dark and hoping that something sticks. But what you're really saying is that you got to be a lot more strategic about it. And there really is a strategy to sales. I think a lot of people do believe that it's about a slick back hair and charm and small talk and giving compliments. And actually what you're saying is it starts with a very strategic understanding of who your clients are. And that's sort of what we teach in our cohorts, and doing a real deep dive on who your client is, getting into their shoes, looking at the world through their perspective, and almost framing your value proposition from that perspective. So I'm curious, what are some of the other big myths that you see students have when they think about sales?
Yeah. So I want to come back to relate this back to an earlier point about academics and the value of research. I think I made the mistake coming back to teach Ivy of saying, you know, I'm not an academic, I'm an entrepreneur. It's all of my experience is practical, and that's why you should listen to me. Which maybe was a little bit, I think, too brash in the beginning, because the problem was I went totally on the opposite end of the spectrum and ended up teaching to my own experiences. But just because something worked for me doesn't mean that it works for everybody else. So I think my build and my evolution, maybe maturation as a teacher, has been, this shouldn't be storytelling about what's worked for me. This shouldn't even be about storytelling and what's worked for me and my friends. It should actually be about that, and more so what's actually true and works across the board for everybody. And I think that's where the value of research comes in, right? So if I'm looking at, for example, what's the best way to send or structure a cold email to get somebody's attention? Most people are going to Google that. And if you're diligent, you're going to end up on maybe the third page of Google, right? That's if you've really, really diligent. Most people stop after the first page. And the challenge is that the people on the first page are people who want to sell you stuff. So HubSpot is a great CRM, but do they actually know the best way to send a cold email, or do they just know how to do search engine optimization to get you to try to buy HubSpot? So I think what's interesting about working in academia is I have an unfair advantage. I get access to, you know, 400 page dissertations and people who have spent 4 years of their life, you know, digging into historically all the research that's been done, conducting all of their own research for thousands of hours to figure out across all of the industries and, you know, isolating all of this, these other variables, what is actually the best way to structure a cold email. So that's been a lot of fun for me to dig into the research and actually make it practical and tangible. Other things that we try to dispel, I think preparation can trump a lot of things. You know, people, what can you actually teach about sales? Well, did you know that there's actually a way that you can better prepare yourself for a meeting? So how should you prepare for a meeting? How should you open a meeting? How should you execute a meeting? What does a good follow-up look like? Like, it doesn't need to be the exact same across the board for everybody, but you should have a thoughtful way, a systematic way of actually approaching those things. So just a few more examples of things that we try to dig into in the class that I think aren't art at all. It's more of the science of sales.
Yeah, and we're big believers in science. You mentioned so many things that when I think of the legal industry and I think of what you're saying, it's like night and day, the difference. So you talked about the word systems. That's not a concept in law. Lawyers don't know what systems are. And Dabble and I, it's funny, the basics, we got to explain, you know, what is a CRM? How do follow-ups work? The fact you even need to send follow-ups. Like, these are in tracking, like, you know, the basics of sales, the basics, I think, that to you, Eric, are so obvious, but they're just not, or at least they're foreign in the legal industry because no one's talked about it. You know, you talked about the value of research and getting those data, you know, that the objective, you know, how what is the best way to send a cold email? And I can tell you the legal industry is allergic to data. They are overflowing with data, but they don't know what to do with it, and it's all unstructured. So I can't even tell you how many newsletters I've seen sent out. And certainly the ones I sent out in my old firm in my first 3, 4, 5 years before I started thinking about these things, no measurement, no tracking, no A/B testing, no knowledge of what an A/B test is. Like, literally just, you know, I'm going to write an article because that's how I get business. And the article goes out in the ether and you just wait for the phone. And of course, no one calls. And you say, I guess I'll write another article. And doing that same thing over and over again without thinking about, you know, are there best practices here that maybe apply in general to humans? And that's, I think, a lot of what we try to bring to the table is taking Dabble's sales expertise, you know, living this, having thought about this, understanding best practices, my legal knowledge, and my understanding of the industry, and putting it together and saying, like you said, Eric, part art, but there's a lot of science here. And I'm curious on your end, you know, what do the students come in believing sales is like? You know, these are people that have filtered into your class, they've self-selected in. What do they actually believe, you know, sales is, and what do they end up sort of coming to believe by the end of the course?
Yeah. So this sort of ties to your last question of some more common myths. So people come in with the preconceived notion that salespeople are extroverted, as an example. And the research shows that that's not true. The best salespeople they're more ambiverts than anything. So they have the ability to sort of be both. They can be, personally, I get a lot of energy from doing things like this and from teaching, but my happy place is if you can lock me in a room for 10 hours where I can write and develop content and figure out how I want to teach a specific concept, that I would love to spend most of my time doing things like that.
I've got to take this episode when it airs and send that clip right there to my wife. That describes me to a T right there.
Yeah. So the best salespeople are actually ambiverts. They have the ability to get up and talk to people. You know, they sometimes can get energy from doing things like this, but they also are very good at sort of doing the detailed work behind the scenes. So that's one myth that we try to debunk. Other preconceived notions that students come into class. I think spray and pray is obviously one of them. Extrovert versus introvert. And just that I try to leave them with a practical toolkit when they walk away that can be applicable to really any business or life interaction that they've got, whether it's like literally maybe a bit of a crude example, but like trying to find a spouse, you know, a dating partner, like a lot of the things that we talk about in class, not appearing to be desperate, not, you know, going after too many targets at the same time. Like a lot of these things are actually very relevant to even the dating scene. So I try to leave them with practical, usable tactics, whether they're going to be full-time salespeople or not.
That makes a lot of sense. Sales is such an important part. In fact, one of the books that we keep coming back to in this podcast is To Sell Is Human by Dan Pink, that it's such a human part of everything you do, whether you're a mom or dad, you're just trying to date someone, trying to, you know, go out there and meet people. In every circumstance, you're going to be doing quote unquote selling, where you're exerting some influence, you're somehow positioning yourself as the expert or as a desirable partner, whatever that might be. Despite its critical importance in human relations, why do you think business schools, and of course law schools as well, have such a low rate of people who even teach sales as a skill? You know, you said, I think less than 5%. Why has it been ignored? Why does it have a bad reputation? Is it the Wolf of Wall Street kind of thing that it's seen as a very shark-like type of environment? Like, what exactly keeps people from not even considering this as a skill to invest in?
So we used to teach it in the 1950s or so. Sales actually was taught pretty broadly across in higher ed. However, there wasn't a ton of research done back in that day, and there was one article that came out through an academic that said, you know, a lot of companies actually train people on the job for sales. And it seems to me that sales is that kind of thing that you can only really learn by doing. So I don't think that we should be teaching it in higher ed as much as we do today. And so that single article, along with a rise of mass marketing, so like, you know, traditional TV commercials, newsletter, billboard advertisements in like the 1940s, 50s, led this massive flow of research and teaching focus on marketing, more traditional marketing. So sales sort of started to fall off, marketing started to rise up. And now the challenge is it's a systemic issue. So in academia, people are rewarded for doing research and getting research published in very, you know, tier one business and management journals. And because there are no tier one business or management journals that focus on sales, professors are not really incentivized to write articles or do research in those areas. So there's no research being done in those areas because journals aren't publishing in those areas. Therefore, there's fewer people that want to get into teaching it. Therefore, there aren't people that want to take PhDs in that. There's no supervisors. There's no notoriety amongst your academic colleagues. It's not going to help you get tenure any faster because there's fewer journals or no journals to publish in. So it's a systemic issue in that the academy or academia doesn't reward people for studying sales. And yet, practically, one of the most useful skills, practical skills, you know, will be the fastest growing profession and the most most people will be in it. And yet we're not teaching it because it's a systemic issue that's broken.
And the funny thing is, I don't think people realize how much you can make in sales, especially tech sales. Like, there's a lot of lawyers out there grinding away, and there's a lot of salespeople with no education, didn't spend 7 years in post-secondary, making way more money than you are and doing a lot less. And that's not to say they don't have to work hard. I'm not saying that at all. But I mean, it is a shockingly lucrative business for people who learn it well and can get to the right place. And I mean, I think people just don't understand that. I think, again, this especially in law, you know, I think back to every year at my old firm, we'd hear, you know, they do a little panel. It was a bunch of older people. Going back to something you said before, Eric, just telling what worked for them. And I always sat there going, like, I don't care. Like none of this is a system. None of this is something I can apply to me. Like, you're a crazy extrovert over here, much more than I am. You know, you got lucky because a new industry came up and that's really where your book was based. For you, it's actually your family connections. And, you know, you don't admit that, but that's the case. And then for other people, just circumstance. But I was always looking for, you know, tell me what I should be doing now and then teach me how to be more effective. Like, we see so many lawyers, and it's funny, in our cohort last week, you know, so they're doing the lunches, they're doing the meetings. And then the question, of course, becomes, so what's next? You know, and they're sort of stymied there, right? Because that follow-up is so foreign. And, you know, so we really try to build these building blocks. But I'm curious, Eric, you know, I want to talk about one of the other courses you teach in a second, but it ties here on the grit part. Like, you can't just give up when the person doesn't respond or you don't get that sale. So how do you teach that part to people?
Yeah, there's a formula that I talk about, and it's there's four elements. It's will, skill, strategy, and luck. Will, skill, strategy, and luck. So I think there's a bit of a formula behind that. If you look at the first two, will and skill, I think those two are additive. So you could be a super skilled person with and not have to put in a ton of ultimately work, or you need to have an incredible work ethic if you're not naturally gifted. So there's an example that I use of my daughter learning to skate, who, like, literally her first time on skates ever because she sees her brother and her mom. I'm a horrible skater. I never played ice hockey growing up, but her mom definitely is a great skater and her brother's a good skater. So she sees her brother skating and is like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to figure it out. So her first time on skates, no skill, all will, she totally figures it out. So I think we spend some time thinking about what does that look like? Because we all know salespeople that are those stereotypical salespeople that do the things that we think maybe aren't as effective, but because they just have such a great work ethic, it ends up working out. Strategy and luck. Again, sort of those are additive, right? In that you can have not a ton of strategy, not super thoughtful about the people that you're going after, but you can get lucky if you send out 1,000 emails and five people respond if they're the right people. So I spend a lot of time thinking about talking about those four elements. What does will look like? There are smart hours that you can be working if sales is not your only job. So looking at the data, there are days and times where people are more likely to read and respond to emails. So if you're a lawyer and you're running your practice, or maybe you've got a partner or two, you've got other work to do. You're paid to do often, you know, the high level, very expensive work. Maybe you're litigating, for example. But there are specific times of your week that I would recommend you block out to do, you know, cold outreach, whether it's calling or emailing or whatever that looks like for you in your calendar. So just as one example, will, skill, strategy, luck. On the will side, I guess it mixed with a strategy, let's block out on your calendar these 4 hours a week where no matter what you're doing, even if you're the senior partner at a firm, you are the one that's actually engaging in those activities. That might be other things for different people, right? So you're doing this podcast as a means to educate your core customer and generate sales. That's a great strategy. So I worked with a friend of mine, became a partner at, it's a consulting firm in the States. It's a retired four-star general who runs a consulting firm now. And a strategy that we came up with on a call was, you know, my gosh, this general should be running his own podcast and reaching out to people to be on the show. And these people who want to be on the show, as you're elevating them and talking to them, could actually be end up becoming your core customers. So again, as it relates to maybe your core audience, could they somehow elevate themselves as a thought leader? And the outreach isn't, you know, hey, cold call, I'm this lawyer that can do this thing for you, but you know, I'm interviewing top people in this industry. And would you be consider being on my podcast as one of those people that I think represents is, you know, what is good or things that are good in that specific vertical? That becomes sort of your networking or your prospecting as you develop a relationship with those people, because now you're top of mind for them when eventually they need those types of services. Just an example.
No, it's a great example. And I think so many lawyers are just focused on, let me just overwhelm you with how great a lawyer I am. And right. Here's where I went to school. You know, almost always every bio is, you know, I graduated from this school in this year. I was called to the bar in that year. I won this award, this and that. But it's like, none of that makes you human. None of that makes me want to buy from you. And I think, you know, we've just been misled, you know, to believe that that lawyers aren't human effectively. And therefore, we try to pretend that, you know, psychology doesn't play a factor here and all these tactics. But the reality is lawyers, customers, clients, what have you, we're all people. And we're all dealing with that. And there are best practices there for sure. But Eric, I want to switch gears a bit. So you've got a second course called Hustle and Grit, or I think Tricky Issues, Hustle and Grit. And it's another one of these courses I wish I had. And it's been funny as I sort of start this business and another business for All Academy earlier this year. Holy crap, I've gotten a crash course in hustle and grit and just all these kind of things you need to navigate as an entrepreneur that I wish I had sort of learned more about. So I'm really curious, you know, what are you doing in that course and what are you doing in general to teach these kind of things?
Yeah, it's an awesome course. So Hustle and Grit is everything I wish I would have learned about entrepreneurship in business school. So these are, we often focus on the tactics and the strategies around entrepreneurship. How do you come up with a good idea? How do you screen it? How do you get it to market? What does your marketing plan look like? Business plan, fundraising, blah, 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 blah. We don't talk about, you know, with a million things on your plate, how do you choose what to prioritize? We don't talk about what does it feel like to have a company fail and how do you bounce back from that? We don't talk about good mental and physical habits to keep you a good functioning whole human. And so these are sort of some of the softer issues, research backed, but some of the softer issues that we just don't allocate a lot of time to in business schools. That's the premise of the course. One of the topics that we cover is specifically rejection and resilience. So I think that the amount of rejection that you face is a leading indicator of future success. So my example, and this is leading to how I teach it, but my son, who's 6 or 7 years old, is super conscious of what other people are like. He's very conscious of what other people are perceiving or how they're observing him. So he's getting to the point where he's too big to ride on the back of my bike. This was a couple of years ago. And he's like having a great time and he's laughing on the back. But as soon as other kids that are his age come around, he like tries to hide. He doesn't want them to see these on the bike. So he's super embarrassed. So I thought, you know, I need to manufacture experiences for him that show him that people honestly don't give a shit. They don't care, right? Like really at the end of the day, people are not watching you as closely as you think they are. So it spurred a thought that we should manufacture these same experiences for my students. Like, let's put them in a bunch of situations where the purpose is to get rejected and just to show them that it really isn't that bad. And so they go on a journey for the Rejection Olympics and they have all of these challenges. And I say, you know, go to Tim Hortons and order a pizza. Go try to return this coffee mug to, you know, Shoppers Drug Mart, which is clearly like not where you bought it. Not being disingenuous, but just genuinely saying like, hey, I bought this coffee mug like 5 years ago and I'm kind of done with it. Is this like, can I return it here? Like purposefully ridiculous things that where they're like, no, you can't. And after 10 or 15 of those, the reflections are always, I was super nervous about doing this. And after doing it 15 times, it actually wasn't that bad. So just one example of the types of things that I want them to experience earlier on that I just think, frankly, took me a little bit too long to learn.
Sounds like that would help them, their dating prospects as well.
That also that.
Rejection really doesn't kill them. That's actually one of the things that really helps us in our cohorts because you're accountable. You're held accountable in front of 7 other people. And if you see a partner in a single firm
going out and, you know, getting rejected, the incentive for you as well to go out there and try it yourself, you know, goes up a lot more because you have no more excuses to hide behind. I wonder if your students still, you know, how do you break through some of the fears that your students might have? Is it through just these manufactured experiences? Do you think the group environment, you know, where everyone's talking, Ivy is notorious for the case study format, does that help as well? Like, how can you effectively break down these fears? Is it about the accountability of a group of peers? Is it just going out there and doing it? Or is there a more quote unquote academic way of overcoming some of these fears and blockers you might have to get out there, sell, get rejected, et cetera?
Yeah, one, you nailed it, Dewal. I think the peer group is super helpful. So seeing, being a part of a cohort of 75 people going through a similar experience at the same time is extremely valuable. So I allocate a lot of time toward the debrief of the activity. You know, how did it go? Did people take videos? Did you take some pictures? Like, what can we share to say that this is all an experience that we've gone through together in real time? So I think the peer element is certainly a helpful component. The other thing that I try to focus on is every topic has a guest, and there's no shortage of older, rich, typically white, typically male people who want to talk about, you know, following your passion. When, if you dig into it, their passion, you know, they've made their billions of dollars from iron ore smelting, and it's hard to, you know, hard to imagine that that's actually what their passion was. And so when I bring in speakers, I specifically try to find people that are maybe one degree of separation from the students that I've got in the class. So they remember what it's like to be 20 years old, 22 years old, and not have any idea what it's like to have your stuff all figured out. I want to bring in people who are willing and vulnerable to share their experience of going through some of the same fears that the students are right now, despite the fact that from an external perspective, they look like they're hugely successful. Or even people who have had, you know, frankly, I've got a handful of guests that are, have had exits in the hundreds of millions range. And for them to come back and not talk about how amazing their life is, but to come back and say, the same way that you're feeling right now with these same hopes and dreams and fears and everything else, I still feel that anxiety today. And here's some of the things that help me, you know, work through it, despite the fact that that feeling persists. So I think having other people in who are also willing to be a little bit vulnerable about what it's really like, not the glorified version of the story that often people tell when they do whatever guest speakers or podcasts or things like that.
I love that. And it's reminding me as you're talking about a company, a legal tech company, two people who started it, I went to law school with, and they exited, I think it was about a year ago at this point, for a healthy amount of money. And there's a group of people in the legal tech space in Toronto, and we have these monthly meetups. And so they came in, and what they talked about, it was this amazing story they shared about how close they were to being totally, totally screwed so many times, how many times they almost gave up, how many times their revenue, like literally you can, they mapped it out. And they would zoom in on that map, you know, between 2015 and 2020, whatever the times were, and talking about, you know, the first 3 or 4 years, they're holed up in somebody's apartment and, you know, just took so long for them to get that traction. And then once they got it, you know, they had a nice little hockey stick kind of growth eventually. But like that journey, I mean, was, there were so many times where they could have quit, where they maybe should have quit or given up, and they didn't and persevered. But the lesson was definitely not, we just exited for, you know, eight figures. Look how great we are. It was actually the opposite, is like, this was a grind, and like, let's tell the real story of what happened. Because as you said, I don't think we do that enough, and we glorify these entrepreneurs who have had success, but most businesses fail. And if you give up when things go poorly, it's not going to go well. And I'm just thinking about Referral Academy, which is my other side business, where we're basically modeling a lot of what Ivy does and teaching lawyers in a much more engaging way, interactive way, the opposite of law school, basically. So Ivy for law school, effectively. And the first firm I pitched it to, I had nothing tangible. I had this idea, and we were offering free training for students over the summer. And I wanted the firms to be supportive of it because they had their students. And the first firm we spoke to, I'm, you know, really excited. And they just looked at me like I was insane. They're like, why would we want this? We don't need this. Our training is perfect, all this stuff. And I was like, oh shit. Okay. That was not the reaction I was expecting here. I'm offering you free something here. And we had another firm, which we will eventually get as a full-time customer for sure. First meeting went well with the key people there. another person on our team had a meeting with their head innovation guy, and he was loving this. He's like, we got to get this literally for everybody. We got to get everybody. He was so gung-ho. You can imagine where that one ended up. It's gone nowhere so far because, you know, you hit certain walls. So we were getting so excited. We're going to get this big firm. It's going to be amazing. We've got so many ideas. And then we're back to zero once again, rejected yet again. And obviously on that journey, you know, we've had a lot more success since then, but it's still a grind. And I just remember thinking, wow, I got to get used to these ups and downs because the highs are high, but the lows get low. And if you can't overcome those, you're in trouble.
Yeah. It's one of my friends is starting his first business and he wanted to meet with me about it. He's like, tell me all the things that no one's telling me. Sort of like having your first kid, you know, everyone's like, oh, it's amazing. It's really amazing. It's great. You're going to love it. It's like, yes, you will. But that first year is pretty challenging. And I don't think people are honest about that. So I think for that friend who was starting a business, I said, think about it like he's doing a renovation on his house at the time. I said, think about it like a kitchen renovation. Like it's going to take longer than you think. It's going to be harder than you think it's going to be. There's going to be more moving pieces. It's going to be way more expensive than you think it's going to be. So like you need to, this is like the precondition, like you need to know these things going in. And I think when people talk about, you know, following your passion, a lot of that is largely terrible advice. But I think doing something that you genuinely care about is great advice because it's going to take longer, be more expensive, and be more frustrating than you think. Anything that's successful ultimately takes upwards of 5, sometimes 10 years. And so if you don't actually care about the thing, you're just going to quit because it's so awful. Like you get 5 years in, if you don't care enough about it, you'll just lose interest and go to the next shiny object. So I think knowing some of those things and just hearing those, often like you get the tweetable follow your passion advice, trying to debunk a lot of that in my classes and not dissuade people from doing something entrepreneurial, but just share the reality of what it's actually like to really get a thing going and how hard it is and how rewarding it is. But I just want people to know that those honest truths from the beginning.
So we're not going to ask you to give your advice, which is not going to be follow your passion. But if people do want to have a more systematic understanding of how to do sales, where can they start? Is it a book that they should pick up? I mean, is there a course that they can take with you? I know you've got a newsletter. How can people start if they want to start developing the skill set in a much more structured, systematic way?
Yeah, I'm still looking for the perfect prescription for where to send people. So I get a lot of requests for this. Right now I teach in a pretty walled garden. So all of my content is really just exclusively at Ivy. I get a handful of requests every week. So I will likely be opening up some sort of public version of it. It will not be competitive to Ivy. You know, I'm still going to teach my same content to the students there. I just think that there are people who will never, are either past the point where they would go to Ivy either for an undergraduate or for an MBA, or it's maybe not in the cards, financially restrictive or whatever. I will likely open something up in the future. I don't know when that is. We're exploring what the 80-20 is. Like, what are the 80% of the things that I could pull out of some of those courses for, you know, maybe 50% of the price or something like that. So if people are interested in following that journey, I've been releasing some of the findings about what the most important things are for salespeople to learn and how to effectively teach them. I've been sharing that in my newsletter over the last few months. I'm going to continue to pull that the research and the insights together and likely move toward launching even version 1 of something in 2022. So if they're interested, they can visit Eric Jansen, just myname.com. And there's a mailing list there that they can sign up for.
That's fantastic. And that's the best way to get a hold of you as well. Do you prefer LinkedIn? How can people get a hold of you?
LinkedIn is probably where I'm most active. They can reach me through my website, but the best way is probably directly through LinkedIn.
Wonderful. Well, thank you. This has been actually a phenomenal episode because we're looking at the kinds of concepts that I don't think any of our guests have covered. Things like manufactured experiences of rejection. That is a beautiful idea. These ideas of preparation for a call. I don't think any of our previous guests has ever brought that up, that you need to prepare for a sales meeting. That's a foreign concept. That all of this stuff is actually a system. You don't need to spray and pray. You can be very strategic about your ideal client and go really deep with those people. So you're offering us a framework, a strategy, and the academic insight that comes from, you know, working at Ivy. And I don't think we've had any guest that's really been this in-depth and detailed about some of these processes. Thank you so much for joining us on this podcast, Eric. This is a true pleasure and delight.
Thanks for having me. And
you've been listening to the Build Your Book podcast. For show notes of this episode and previous episodes, go to buildyourbook.org/podcast. Our mission is to change the culture of law practice with these conversations. Please help us in this by sharing this podcast with your friends and colleagues, and help us get these ideas to more listeners by leaving us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. It really makes a difference. It takes less than 30 seconds and helps us bring on more great guests for you. Thanks for listening. Take care.